Welcome back to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Amber Khan. The extreme violence at the hands of Buddhist nationalists in Myanmar contradicts with popular stereotypes of this faith tradition that many Americans associate with the Dalai Lama and Richard Gere. But Susan Hayward, Senior Advisor of Religion and Inclusive Studies at the U.S. Institute of Peace, reminds us there are different branches of Buddhism. In Myanmar, Theravada, a more literalist, conservative tradition, is dominant. Moreover, Hayward says Buddhism, like all religions, is not immune to conflict.
So I think there can be a lot of cognitive dissonance for folks when they hear about Buddhism being used to justify violence or exclusionary policies towards other ethnic or religious groups. But the reality, if you look at Buddhist history, is that Buddhism has been used to justify violence. Various Buddhist ideas have been used to legitimate violence against different groups in order to defend the Buddhist tradition. And Buddhism has also been drawn on by the state in order to legitimate exclusionary policies. Buddhism, like any religious tradition, is complex and vast, and it's composed of humans.
And religion is also a common bedfellow of politics. Theravada Buddhism has had a long and symbiotic relationship with the government of Myanmar before and after independence.
The historic Buddhist kingship model is that the king and the state supports the Sangha, the monastic community, and provides through security and providing wealth and resources that allows the monastic community to flourish. And the monastic community depends on the state for protection for those resources, and it depends on the state for being able to kind of manage internal conflicts and ensure strict discipline within the monastic community. And then it provides religious legitimation and karmic benefit to the state to ensure its own flourishing politically. That's the root of the Buddhist kingship model that continues to be kind of the fundamental frame and belief of how the relationship between state and religion should manifest within the country.
Because church and state are so linked in Myanmar, the national identity is intimately tied to being Buddhist. Anxiety that Buddhist values were weakening grew under British rule, with the influx of unwanted outsiders from other parts of the British Raj. That helped fuel the rise of Buddhist nationalism as a form of resistance.
There is rooted in this kind of a latent xenophobia, a fear about foreign influence that is seeking to displace Burmans and Burman decision-making and Buddhism as the religion. So that concern, which is rooted very much in colonial experiences of usurpation. And remember that when the British colonial powers came in, it was a very slow takeover of the country over 5 decades, right? It started in southern Burma and toppled kings moving up north. And so there was a growing anxiety over 50 years that led to this real entrenchment of suspicion of foreign influences and foreign powers that has become rooted in a lot of the state structures and laws, including citizenship laws. So those ethnicities or groups of people that are seen as foreign, defined as foreign, are looked at suspiciously as a threat to the state or as a threat to the social, cultural, religious norms and fabric of the country.
Today, Hayward says the average Myanmar citizen still supports a strong Buddhist presence in the country. The most prominent Buddhist nationalist organization and the group most responsible for spreading anti-Muslim rhetoric has been Ma Ba Tha.
Ma Ba Tha defines as its mission the desire to ensure that Buddhism remains thriving and that it remains a moral touchstone for the state and for society, which is a concern that is derived out of both the colonial anxiety of when Buddhism had experienced a severe weakening of itself, of the Buddhist institutions, Buddhist practices, boys going into the monkhood and so on and so forth during that era, but also an essential Theravada Buddhist millenarian concern that eventually Buddhism is going to die out. So the Buddha himself said that in 5,000 years, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddhism, are going to disappear.
As Hayward described this, it made me think of the concept of the end of days, revelation, reckoning, and the fears that that can stoke. So she argues the worry about Buddhism losing its power in Myanmar society isn't just a product of colonialism and xenophobia. It's rooted in the Theravada tradition itself.
And so at this point, if Buddha was born around the 5th century BCE, we're at about the halfway point of the lifetime of Buddhism. And so there is a sense among some Buddhists, and some Theravada Buddhists in particular, that as we reach kind of the apex and begin this era of the dissolution of Buddhism or the loss of Buddhism, that we have to put in even more effort to ensure that Buddhism is being protected, Buddhism is being revived.
Additionally, Hayward says there's a lot of anxiety surrounding just how Buddhism fits into our modern world.
And then this gets fit within the geopolitical and the global context, where Buddhists, and I think particularly Theravada Buddhists, they look at the Christian world or they look at the Muslim world, and they see that a great deal of political mobilization, of economic wealth, has been vested in the Christian and the Muslim world. And in terms of development activities, in terms of humanitarian activities, much less international organizations and global power and so on. And so they feel this anxiety that the Buddhist world hasn't similarly organized itself in such a way that they can have that great deal of an influence on global politics, on regional politics, and then that manifests in a national setting by Buddhism is potentially not going to be strong enough to withstand the power of the Muslim world or of the Christian world. So that plays into the support that Mabata has, because there's a concern that if we're not putting a great deal of energy into ensuring that Buddhism is being inculcated in young kids these days, that especially with the opening up of, you know, new forms of entertainment, new forms of media and so on that could potentially lure kids away from their religious traditions, if we're not putting a great deal of effort in ensuring that Buddhism remains alive and thriving, that it has the potential to disappear. And that can seem counterintuitive when it's 88% of the population in the country, right? Mm-hmm. If you go and visit Myanmar, Buddhism is everywhere. Right. It's everywhere. It's so strong. So the idea that there would be some anxiety that Buddhism could potentially be swallowed up is hard sometimes.
However, Hayward adds that just because the majority of Burmese support the idea of preserving Buddhism in their society doesn't mean that they automatically support anti-Muslim violence. In fact, some people are challenging Mabata's anti-Muslim rhetoric.
So there are those within Mabata who are associated with that organization who will sometimes be critical, sometimes, often not enough for those of us who are really committed to human rights. But they will be critical of other Mabata leaders who are expressing anti-Muslim sentiment. There's also a body called the Mahanayaka Council, which is a state-appointed council of Buddhist leaders who issue rulings that are internal to the Buddhist community. And so it's called Mahana, by short. So the Mahana has also issued some rulings in recent years that have sought to curb Mabata and its activities, and have been seen as the most kind of virulent speaker for Mabata is Ashin Uwirathu, a monk who is based in Mandalay. And Mahana in 2016 passed a ruling saying that Ashin Uwirathu couldn't preach for a year because of his anti-Muslim rhetoric and so on. So there's some of these activities by the state-sponsored council that have sought to curb Mabata or be critical of Mabata's anti-Muslim expressions. And then there's a great many interfaith activities.
And the interesting thing about these interfaith coalitions against anti-Muslim violence, ironically, is that they have been made possible by the same thing that allowed Mabata to gain prominence: democratization.
With the opening and the new space that has provided, it has advanced different kinds of political changes and social changes that have allowed people to mobilize nonviolently. Since 2010, 2011, in this opening, it created the space on the religious side for a great many more public interfaith and interethnic campaigns, mobilizations, activities to take place that would not have been allowed under the military regime previously, because the military regime would have seen interfaith or interethnic forms of mobilization as potentially a threat to state security. Myanmar has been going through an extraordinary degree of change. It was rooted in a constitution that was drafted in 2008 that is called Discipline Flourishing Democracy. And what it sought to do was open up the space in Myanmar for various kinds of political and economic reforms while still ensuring that the military controlled a great deal of the center of power. So beginning in 2011, there was actually some very swift changes that occurred in opening up the media space, opening up the space for political mobilization. The historic opposition group, the National League of Democracy, was allowed to function, was allowed to mobilize, was allowed to run for office. There were many political prisoners who were released almost overnight. And it also led to the opening up of the country to the international world.
So in this way, democratization has been sort of a double-edged sword, all at once allowing the most extreme fear-mongering voices to become the loudest, while also allowing for others to organize in opposition and form new alliances like interfaith groups.
And some of those interfaith activities that have taken place have manifested in large part in response to the rise of anti-Muslim violence that was taking place around the country in Rakhine State and beyond. And so they have sought to address some of the rumors about Islam, the negative rumors and perceptions about Islam. They have sought to analyze environments and see when tensions are rising between ethnic or religious communities and to mediate, to try to de-escalate those tensions before violence breaks out. They have sought to advocate for the passage of laws like the intercommunal harmony law or the anti-religious hate speech law that they believe will help to curb hate speech and actions on behalf of Mabata and some other groups that have led to violence. And there's a lot of youth-led movements as well that have attempted to promote love speech or to promote interfaith relationships and respect.
Hayward adds these new alliances, inspired by the plight of Rohingya and other minorities, include women's rights advocates and survivors.
And so it's some of the women's groups who have been the most vocal in criticizing the Buddhist nationalist groups and some of the gendered narratives of the Buddhist nationalist groups, which often focus on the supposed vulnerability of women, the need to protect women. But then, ironically, when the women's rights groups criticize Mabata, they're targeted with death threats and threatened with violence because of their activities. But it's also been the women's rights groups who have spoken out in support of the Rohingya, often saying, the Karen women's group that issued a statement in support of the Rohingya and the Rohingya women said, listen, the experiences the Rohingya women are facing in terms of the forms of sexual violence, their children being taken away from them and killed, we know those experiences because we've experienced them as well. And so they come together out of this shared experience of violence and of exploitation.
Moving forward, Hayward says that there are still many ongoing armed conflicts in several different states across Myanmar, all of which need to de-escalate before the Rohingya crisis can improve.
I mean, the biggest question right now is, will the Rohingya return to Rakhine State? And that depends on if they feel safe to return and that there's something to return to, that they'll have opportunities to flourish and to live peacefully and to participate in political decision-making and to have schools and to feel secure to come back. And of course, they should not be forced to return if they don't feel comfortable doing so. There's a lot more that needs to be done in order to build both the local environment that will allow them to return and then address the issues at the federal level. Some of these issues are just particular to the Rohingyas, particularly in terms of citizenship. But a number of these issues, political and economic and social and so on, are issues that are faced by a lot of the ethnic minorities within the country that need to be addressed in order to create a pluralistic state.
But Hayward holds out hope for the future of Myanmar.
The people of Myanmar are incredibly resilient. They have faced extraordinary challenge and different forms of violence for decades. During the colonial period, during the post-independence period, under the military regime, and then these latest manifestations. I am always incredibly humbled when I meet with the activists, many of whom have spent time in prison. They served as political prisoners. Their commitment and courage and resilience and hope to keep moving, despite the fact that oftentimes it seems like they're going backwards rather than forwards, and especially the last year or two. Because of them, I continue to have hope that the country will continue to move forward, that the commitment to human rights, the commitment to creating an environment where the incredible diversity of the country can flourish and be seen as an asset rather than a threat is possible.
Susan Hayward is Senior Advisor of Religion and Inclusive Studies at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Our episode on Myanmar was part of our God and Government series supported by the Henry R. Luce Foundation. You can hear our previous episodes at interfaithradio.org/God and Government. The Burmese music you've heard throughout this episode was from a 2008 recording by Aung Win, a group of traditional musicians from Myanmar. Producers for this special include Stephanie Lecce and Melissa Fato, with a special thanks to Kevin McCarthy, Axel Kronholm, and Ruth Morris. To learn more about the conflict, visit interfaithradio.org, where you can find show notes, links to articles, and other resources. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter and subscribe to our podcast. I'm your host, Amber Khan. See you next week.